Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back, Mason State Rep. Tom Cochran. Among those in support of a measure that would allow Michigan communities to install cameras at intersections and use photos from them to get tough on people who run red lights and other driving infractions. Those cameras are currently prohibited by state law in Michigan. Representative Cochran says, quote, "This is about people changing their behavior, hopefully so we don't have incidents where people are injured or killed," unquote. The bill reportedly has bipartisan support, but it is also opposed by both some police organizations and civil liberties groups. Debate on those bills began yesterday. We have an interesting show here for you today. At the top, one of the first casualties of the Great Recession was the U.S. housing market. The bubble burst back in 07, and over time, home values reached historic lows. Now, a rising demand for new housing is driving a nationwide recovery. But one problem is that many skilled workers who lost their jobs in the past 6 years have moved on. Now, residential home builders are struggling to find enough labor to meet the demand. We have two guests here to talk about the issue. Bob Filka is CEO of the Home Builders Association of Michigan. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Mark.
And James Lynch is the program director for the residential building program at Lansing Community College. Hi, Jim.
Morning, Mark.
Well, we remember some dark, dark days back in 09 and thereabout. A lot of people wondered if this day was ever going to arrive, a shortage of workers to build all the new homes people want or need. Please comment on this long-awaited turnaround.
Well, it's a good problem to have,
sure,
given how far our industry has fallen over the last 6 years. I mean, literally about 60,000 people lost their jobs in the residential construction industry in the last 6 years. Because we used to build between 35 and 45,000 homes a year in the state of Michigan just to keep up with demographic changes, job changes throughout the state. You can add up all the homes that were built in the last 6 years and they wouldn't reach those numbers.
Wow.
And so virtually, we've been at a standstill. We've not built any new homes in the last 6 years from a general standpoint.
It's ironic you should be here today, because one of the other stories in the news today is that a Whole Foods store is opening in the city of Detroit. So we're talking here about workers in an industry that are finally needed after all these years of recession and slowdown. On the same day that a Whole Foods store is opening up in the city of Detroit, another incredible turnaround story. So what has happened to these people who quit who dropped out of construction over the years? Where are they?
Initially, many of them traveled to other states where the construction bust didn't hit as hard, places like Texas and the Dakotas and elsewhere. But a lot of people left the industry, found new careers, retired. That's really what happened. They just disappeared, and it's kind of a lot of people weren't aware, because many of these contractors, many of them are independent contractors. They don't typically show up on a lot of unemployment statistics, and so they're kind of the ghost unemployed, if you will, from the recession that people weren't really aware of. But now we're very aware, because we can't find workers for our builders.
And Jim Lynch, tell us how Lansing Community College figures into this. You're trying to correct this shortage of workers.
Yeah, we get calls all the time from contractors looking for builders. We don't have a whole bunch because no one was coming into the program, and we're trying to kickstart that to get them back in. We're reaching down to the high school program that we have, and we have going out to students. I probably talked to 1,500 students in a given year, talking to them about building trades and the things that they can do, and it's a very good employment and salary when they start doing it.
I imagine. Bob Filka, are any of these people returning, though, who have dropped out for a
while? Well, eventually, I think I certainly believe in supply and demand, but wages are going to rise as a result to try and attract people back to the sector. And so, really, housing affordability will become an issue. And so, eventually, yes, I think you'll see some of them come back. But quite honestly, I believe the vast majority are not coming back. And so, it's really incumbent upon our programs like those at LCC, our K through 12 schools, actually a number of voc ed programs across the state, at our ISDs that are across the state, students have been somewhat inhibited in getting into those programs over the last few years because we changed our state merit curriculum to require a number of different college prep types of classes.
Exactly.
And in fact, I was just down in Ann Arbor at a great program, and they turn away two-thirds of the students that want to get into their construction program, their voc ed construction program, because the kids can't complete all the graduation requirements in time to graduate if they were to enroll in that voc ed program. So we believe, in fact, we're pushing some legislation that would allow some flexibility. We believe the parents and the schools ought to be given a little more flexibility in how students meet that curriculum, and we need to get the kids back into those construction trade programs at the K-12 level.
Okay, that is a legislation that's inside the Capitol right now, correct?
Correct.
Jim Lynch, tell us what a student coming to LCC who wants to acquire these skills, what options do they have?
Well, we have a couple different options. Obviously, you can go right into our construction program, and the first two semesters. Then that following summer, we have internships for those students, and good paid internships. The other option is to come through our construction management program, which is a kind of covers all the construction fields, plumbing, heating, air conditioning, and obviously building.
So you offer certifications.
Correct.
And you offer degrees as
correct.
Well?
Correct. Associate degrees.
Okay. The HBA, I see, is forecasting a 40% increase in the number of new residential construction building permits in the state by the end of 2013. Tell us more about that.
Sure. And that means this year we'll build about 14,000 homes in Michigan.
And for a while it was between 30 and 35,000?
Well, about 35 to 45. So really we're not even up to half of what would be normal.
And we're excited about
that. And we're excited about that, but quite frankly, with the availability or the lack thereof of labor, we can't build a whole lot more than that in the coming years. That's why continued pressure is going to be there on existing home values, because we're not going to be able to meet the new construction demand. Even if our builders had unlimited capital available to build, the lack of workers is going to impede our ability to get back up to those numbers. In fact, there's some concern. Some economists will tell you they're concerned about another bubble forming eventually. Although Michigan never had the big, one of the misnomers that I fight with a lot of folks is Michigan never had the big buildup in home values like you saw in other parts of the country.
Recession started early.
Exactly,
here.
Exactly. Yeah. We had a decade-long time period where that bubble kind of slowly, fizzed. Whereas
exactly.
The rest of the country was a big pop.
The lost decade, right?
And so I don't, I think the reality is, on average, people buy a home historically that's about three times their household income. So if your household is earning $50,000 a year, you typically buy a $150,000 house. I mean, those are the statistics. Our number is actually down to about 1.8 times your income in terms of the average value of a home in Michigan right now to your household income. So we have a lot of room to grow to get back to that historical average.
Mm-hmm.
At the peak, Michigan was still not even up to 4-to-1 in terms of values, whereas places like the Southwest and California, those income-to-value ratios were as high as 8 or 9-to-1. So people making $50,000 were buying a $500,000 house in many markets.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been at LCC, Jim?
I've been since 1991. I worked in an engineering firm, and then I became a full faculty after 23 years in the private sector, and then I became the director of our design and construction programs 2 years ago.
How would you gauge the interest in these kinds of programs over the years at Lansing Community College?
At one time, our building program was just huge. I mean, we have about a 8,000 square foot building lab at West Campus, LCC's West Campus. So it was at a real peak. And now over the last 3, 4, 5 years, the enrollment is really down. So we're not sending students out into the real world as many as we'd like to. But I see now, coming up to this summer and into the fall, our interest is peaking. I also advise those students, so I get phone calls and work with them to set their schedules too.
But that it sounds like it's market driven interest in these programs.
But part of the problem is awareness, and one of the things we're trying to do is ring the alarm bell and say to, and let families know, let parents know, let kids know that there are great career opportunities now, and there are many great programs that are like yours that are still out there, and get your kids into those programs because there's great jobs right after you get through with those programs. We're talking starting wages $20, $25, $30 an hour.
The housing slump aside, though, is there generally would there have been less interest in this kind of work anyway for any reason?
We were talking earlier, you know, it's not that sexy type career, you know, it's a roll your sleeves up and but
exactly.
It's a very rewarding field, you know, as you're driving down the road and say, hey, I worked on that building.
Yeah.
I think, so you got to weigh that, you know, and when you're sitting around the dinner table at home, your folks aren't saying, hey, why don't you become a contractor? Why don't you be a builder? They're not saying that.
They're thinking Elon Musk designing a video game or a hundred other things.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think there's a problem, even if we weren't in a down cycle, we would have had problems continuing to get kids into these programs.
Okay.
And
that was really my question.
Yeah. The ultimate,
there are other forces
in
play.
But the ultimate story for consumers is not good news. I mean, ultimately, costs are going to rise. I mean, truly, it's going to cost more. It's going to take longer to do the contract, whether it's building a new house or repairs on your house. Things are going to start to slow down. And for the last few years, consumers have been somewhat spoiled in getting multiple bids from contractors and having contractors respond immediately to their needs. The reality is now that's going to start changing, and we're going to go back to times where, you know, geez, my contractor won't call me back, and I can't. Well, it's because they are super, super busy, and they don't have enough employees.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm curious to ask both of you how long you've been – when did you become aware of the possibility of a worker shortage in this? I mean, has this been sudden, or was this on your radar a couple of years ago?
A couple of years ago, because we saw so many people losing their jobs in the construction sector, and knowing that at some point the cycle had to come back around, and we needed to build more new homes. It's been on our radar for a couple of years. I think getting people's attention to say, oh, yeah, right, we're going to, you know, how. In fact, we were fighting 2 years ago to try and keep our voc-ed programs. There was a movement in order to get federal funding to change all the voc-ed programs at K-12 level to more of a virtual platform and get rid of the hands-on construction programs.
Mm.
We had to fight with the State Department of Education to keep those programs in place because we were concerned. I mean, hands-on training, whether it's for residential construction or highway construction or commercial construction, is really vitally important to those industries. And there was a move to only expose kids to construction in a virtual world, online. And we're saying, no. We need to keep those hands-on programs in place. So we've been fighting for a couple of years to try and keep that drum going to say, we're going to need workers.
So you know, same thing. I mean, we just saw the decline in enrollment. So we immediately said, you know, it's got to turn around. So we tried to put a marketing strategy in to recruit kids, students to come into the program.
Okay. Bob Filka is CEO of the Home Builders Association of Michigan, and he was joined by Jim Lynch, who is program director of the Residential Building Program at Lansing Community College. Good luck, guys.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. The Lansing Symphony Orchestra is playing a free pops concert tonight at 7 in downtown Lansing's Adato Riverfront Park, and WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with conductor Timothy Muffet about the program.
This is a retrospective of the music of the 80s, and I mean, what it really is, it's a fun time for everybody to come downtown and experience downtown Lansing on a beautiful summer night with the Lansing Symphony, and we have a couple of wonderful guests that are going to join us and take us through through that great decade and all the wonderful pop music from the 80s.
Well, you know, when I heard you were doing this concert, I think that the first thought that came to me, and I'm sure it did to a lot of people, was whether you were going to be doing a cover of Breaking the Law by Judas Priest.
That one's not on there, but you know, we do have, there's Billy Idol on there. And
that's close.
We got David Bowie, and it's a really beautiful program. This program was put together by the company that's coming in, and it's just a great mix of many different styles that everyone will know all of these songs, and it's just a terrific representation. And it's going to be a lot of fun, I think.
What were you listening to in the 80s, either on the radio or not on the radio?
Well, I've always been kind of a musical omnivore, really. Obviously, you know, I work in the world of classical music, and I love classical music, and that's what I listen to, but I like all kinds of music.
So what were you listening to in the 80s?
In the 80s? Well, in the 80s, I would have been a student, so I would have been on a fairly heavy classical diet. But if I'm around friends, then the music that you're going to hear tonight was certainly music that was in the air, music that was in the car, music that was in the home. And, you know, we all had roommates back then. But it's great stuff. And these are fantastic. You know, you might think, well, how's this going to work with a symphony orchestra? It's... we've got not only the orchestra there, but we have all the necessary accoutrement of this music with guitar, electric bass, drum set, percussion section, keyboards, two singers that will really pull it off well. And the orchestra, it's a terrific set of arrangements for the group, too.
Do you find, is there one particular song that you play and go, you know, I wasn't that big of a fan when it came out, but the bones of this are actually better than I thought. It's held up better than I thought it would.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if there are any that would fall into the category of I didn't think they were good at the time. But rehearing some of these tunes, I think probably has made me reappreciate them.
When I was little, we used to go to the DSO symphonies at Oakland University and mm-hmm. sit on the hill, and they were classical. Sometimes they were pops. But I thought, I really felt like I got my first real exposure to orchestra, the orchestral sound and the richness of that by going to those live concerts. Is there an element of kind of, you know, bringing this when you do an outdoor concert that maybe people who've just never heard it before are going to get turned on to that sound?
I think so. That's, you know, certainly we want to be everybody's orchestra here in Lansing. And we know that musical tastes vary, and here's an opportunity for us to really reach out and have a lot of people have a point of engagement with the Lansing Symphony. And it's a free concert. It's outdoors. It's downtown. It's music everybody knows and loves. Hopefully people that haven't heard the orchestra before will come away thinking, I like that. I like that a lot. And will check us out for our indoor pop series, where we play music very similar to this at times and other popular-oriented music. You know, the Lansing Symphony is full of 21st century musicians who can work in any style of music with a very high degree of professionalism. And they understand this style as well as they understand the style of Mozart and Beethoven and will be able to deliver. So hopefully we will really connect with our audience and the people of Lansing will be proud of their orchestra.
Timothy Muffet, thanks for joining us and good weather to you for the concert.
Thank you. It's looking good.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. It's Wednesday and time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, it's the Friends of Ingham County Parks. The group works with local government to support park operations. And here to tell us more about the group, Karen Fraser, Friends of Ingham County Parks Director of Development. Welcome, Karen.
Good morning.
What does Friends of Ingham County Parks do exactly?
Well, the Friends have been around for quite a long time. They actually received their 501c3 nonprofit back in 1999. The group started out with an awesome gentleman, Ed Gillespie. If you're listening out there, thank you again. He organized a group of people and built a playground at Lake Lansing Park. A couple of years later, those people wanted something else to do, and they built a band shell at Lake Lansing Park. It was at that time he said, they were informal. We need a Friends group. And so he took care of getting the Friends actually formally organized. And since that time, they've done a variety of projects. We did the playground at Hawk Island a few years ago. More recently, in 2008, the Friends raised money to help the county with a land purchase at Lake Lansing North Park. And we've done a lot of smaller things with wheelchairs for the parks, a drinking fountain for the parks, sidewalks for the parks. We're there to support the parks.
I understand that your mission is changing a little bit more recently, though, and you're involved in actually financing.
Well, yes. It's unfortunate and really difficult to almost accept, but the parks, the Ingham County parks, which actually people should know are Lake Lansing Parks, Hawk Island Park, and Birchfield Park out in Holt, have really lost a significant amount of funding in the last four budget cycles. In 2010, the big reduction of $500,000 happened, and since then we've lost another $100,000 plus. And I think that it's taken everyone some time to realize that things have just changed, and there was an expectation that parks on the community's part, even on Parks Department staff, the Parks Commission, that parks were always going to be funded through an appropriation from the county. And that is just not the case anymore, and it's certainly not the case across the country. What's happened to Ingham County Parks isn't any different than what's happened to a lot of Parks Departments. Mm-hmm. So now we enter into the era of building relationships with our community, with businesses, with foundations, to actually help support the parks and ensure that they keep operating.
A more aggressive approach? A more creative approach?
That's a more structured and more creative approach for certain. This year is really the first year that we had sat down as a Friends group and a Friends board and said, okay, we need to raise $20,000. Mm-hmm. We need to do that to help run the parks.
And how have you done that?
Well, we have applied for grants. We have three events going on this year, the first of which will be August 15th out at Lake Lansing Park South. That event is Cuisine and Carousels, kind of looking back to the history of that park and how meaningful that is to our community. We have a kids event scheduled for September 21st at Hawk Island Park, which we did last year, Touch a Truck. So a lot of businesses and organizations brought in things like fire trucks and dump trucks. We did that a little later last year. It was cold, it was snowing, and 600 people came. So I think we should have a good turnout. And then we are actually working with Playmakers to do a running type event, nature of which to be defined in November.
From your interactions with people in the community, what do you hear that people would like to see in the parks most often?
I think people would like some of the fees that have been created to go away or to be reduced because of the lost appropriation fees had to be increased and added to. The other piece I think that people love, and we've certainly seen this demonstrated at Hawk Island, is trails. Trails are something people love. They want them to be near their homes. They want them to be easily accessible. We have some good trail system in the Ingham County Parks at this time. We have, I think there's about 5 miles of trails at Lake Lansing North, which are natural trails. They're earth and very nice, actually good for your good for walking on. Out at Birchfield Park, there's another 6 miles of trails that are nature trails that are great. And there's actually an advanced biking trail out there, which is really cool.
It's been exciting to see the expansion. And I think Hawk Island really, really grabbed a lot of people's mm-hmm. attention. Great to kayak out there. Yeah. It's just a great facility.
Hawk Island is the busiest park we have.
Really? I'm not surprised to hear that.
It's not surprising at all, is it, when you go there? Over 500,000 people go there each year. And so actually, to put all of this in perspective as far as the money piece, we are operating, the Parks Department is operating with less money now than before Hawk Island existed.
Oh, my.
So that is that just stands out real clearly to me, and I don't think people realize that.
How does support for the county parks play out on the County Board of Commissioners? Do you have people who are advocating for a stronger parks budget there?
I don't know that that's the case. I think that the county commission is looking at alternative funding for the parks.
Okay.
They support the parks. They realize what an important part of the community parks are. Parks really are a pillar in the community. They're a big reason why people want to come and live somewhere. It's because of things like parks and where can I go to the theater and those, you know, fun recreational things. And I think at this point, the commission is trying to look at alternative sources of funding for the parks system.
We're talking with Karen Fraser of the Friends of Ingham County Parks. Do you have any contact with the city of Lansing here as far as your group goes? I mean, is there some kind of relationship, communication, connection with the Lansing Parks people?
The Friends of Ingham County Parks don't have a close relationship with the city of Lansing, but the Parks Department certainly has. And we've, you know, worked on different things with them over the years. The soccer complex comes to mind. The soccer complex is actually owned by the city of Lansing, but we currently operate that for them.
Oh.
The Solden Dog Park that is adjacent to Hawk Island Park is owned by the city of Lansing, and we have an arrangement, an agreement by which the county park system operates that for them. So, yes, there's definitely a working relationship at the county and city level between those two organizations.
Is there a story that represents why you got involved with the Friends of Ingham County Park?
Well, at first, really, it was because of my job. Because I do work for Ingham County and for the Parks Department, and a piece of my job was to work with the Friends. However, it's really become a large, large part of my job now to do that, and I enjoy it very much. And actually, historically, I realized after I was with the Parks for a period of time that the very, very first job I ever had where I received a paycheck was at the City Park in St. John's, and I was a concession worker. So as life goes, it seems like I've come full circle. But, you know, I personally, I love the parks. I use the parks. I realize how important they are to people. When we opened the playground at Hawk Island Park, I overheard a woman say to one of our board members, Alfreda Schmidt, she said, "This park is the nicest thing anyone has ever done for the South side of Lansing." Mm. And when you hear something like that, you can't help but want to do more.
How many members are there in your group?
We have a board of 9 members that meet periodically. And then as far as volunteers, you know, we'll have an event or a group, and with a playground build, as an example, we had 2,000 people come out to help build that playground. So on a day-to-day basis, we may not have a large group of volunteers out there, but we're really with a project, we'll get a lot of people come in. We have people that help us take care of gardens in the parks.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great group that's helping with the disc golf course out at Birchfield Park now. Volunteers mean a lot to the Ingham County Parks, especially with the shrinking budget scenario.
And if somebody is listening who'd like to get involved and get behind this cause, what do they call? What number do they call?
They would call me, Karen, 244-7186.
244-7186. Karen Fraser is Director of Development for the Friends of Ingham County Parks, a nonprofit that works to support the maintenance and operation of our parks. Thanks for joining us today, Karen.
Thank you. It was wonderful to be here.
Good to hear about your group. We could always use more nominations, and Current State knows there are great people and organizations out there doing great work. If you'd like one to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Thanks for joining us for Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. An East Lansing-based economic developer is pursuing a project in Libya, one it says would benefit Michigan companies and universities. The Prima Civitas Foundation, along with Michigan and global partners, wants to coordinate and proceed with the construction of a new university and city, probably near Benghazi, Libya. The opportunity comes a few years after a similar one in Iraq, which has stalled due to financing challenges. Here to tell us about this Libyan project and to update the one in Iraq, Prima Civitas Director of International Programs, Patrick McRae. Patrick, nice to see you.
You too, Mark. Thank you.
How did this opportunity in Libya unfold exactly?
Well, this opportunity came to us from the exposure from the Iraq project. We've been cooperating with a number of other entities in that part of the world, and we were invited because of our expertise in certain areas, education being one of those. We were invited to join another coalition of global firms that was pursuing this project in Libya, or was well placed there.
Okay.
We were invited to come in to look at this university project, and our part of the team is to provide the everything non-construction related. That would be the curriculum planning and development, a staffing plan. It's more or less everything that would turn a group of buildings into a living, breathing university.
I see. Okay. So, and clarify, please, this Libyan project will happen. It's just not clear who gets the project, or it's not been determined that the project will necessarily happen.
Well, nothing's ever certain, unfortunately.
Okay.
But it has been publicly stated in Libya that this is a high priority project of the Libyan government, notwithstanding recent changes. It's still a national priority to start investing in education again at the higher level.
This might be a good juncture to back up and explain what Prima Civitas does and how you come to be involved in projects like this one.
Yeah, Prima Civitas is an interesting organization. We're a small group, but we get involved in projects that, at their core, whether here in the state of Michigan or regionally or internationally, have a positive impact both on the state of Michigan and, in the case of international projects, on the host country. And by positive impact, I mean commercial opportunity, economic opportunity, noble causes such as education, home building, that sort of thing. Projects that bring improvement, hope, opportunity to host countries, especially in post-conflict regions where there's not a lot of positive projects going
on. So you do focus on those parts of the world. Obviously, they do offer unique rebuilding opportunities.
Correct. Yeah, we've emerged as specialists in post-conflict reconstruction, and we're on a very effective team of global firms that have the same sort of appetite and expertise.
So if this Libya project, and the Iraq project for that matter, were to play out, connect those dots a little bit for us. Where would the payoff be for Michigan schools and Michigan companies?
Well, in the university project, for instance, the eventual student population there will be about 30,000 to 50,000 students.
Wow,
that's a lot of pre-qualification screening, English language training that has to take place. We're well connected to the, of course, the ESL programs here in East Lansing with Michigan State and others, and with the community colleges in Michigan to deliver not only ESL programs, but we're going to employ up to 30,000 locals on those projects. And that entails a lot of construction trades training and that sort of thing. The LCC guys that were just in here a little while ago would be in position to offer some of the training that we would need to, we'd like to employ locals. And those locals, because of the dictatorships that have overseen those countries for so long, haven't been subject to any training, haven't benefited from anything, any investment in education. So there's a lot of construction, a lot of opportunity, but not a lot of skills in the current pool.
And so I know on the Iraq project, which surfaced a couple of years ago, Prima Civitas is affiliated with, or you work with construction firms and lenders and training and design, everything that's involved in a large-scale project. You're saying the Libyan the Libyan project would focus primarily on education.
Correct. Our portion of the Libyan project would focus on education. Our partners on that project happen to be a major Turkish construction firm.
You've done a lot of work in Turkey. There's been a lot of connections. You've made a few trips to Turkey, understand it correctly.
Yeah, made quite a few trips there. We have our Turkish Resource Center of North America is housed at Prima Civitas. We're facilitating business exchanges and matchmaking tours or trips to Turkey. We're acting as a conduit to promote bilateral trade between the two countries because that's a current situation notwithstanding. Again, it's a very vibrant market for U.S. firms that want to get established there or in that part of the world.
Prima Civitas got involved in a similar initiative, plans for a huge community a couple of years ago in Baghdad. I know funding it became something of a challenge. Where does that stand today?
It's a huge challenge. It boils right down to the deal structure itself was not sufficiently attractive to global money.
Okay.
When investors put in something they want, they have a certain expectation of return. And in that part of the world with the risk profile in that country, it's something north of 25% return on investment.
Is the deal still got legs or is it in the past?
It still has legs because the Iraqi government fortunately has come around and recognized that they have to sweeten the pot for the investment community to take a serious look at these projects.
So discussions are still going on.
Very recently, the deal structure has improved quite substantially, and we have renewed interest on the financial front.
There was a Michigan State grad that played a significant role in the Iraqi opportunity here, Dr. Sami Al-Araji. Tell our listeners about him.
Yeah, he's quite a character. He was here getting his advanced degrees back in the late 60s, I believe. Late 60s, early 70s. Returned to Baghdad, like many international MSU alums, emerged, came up through the ranks and he holds a special spot in his heart for MSU in the state of Michigan and came back and invited us to put together this team for this project.
Okay. NPR reported earlier today what a deadly month May was in Iraq. How big a challenge is the unrest there in moving forward with the Iraq project?
It's a challenge, and these environments are very challenging. But we maintain our strong opinion that projects like these provide hope, stability, and future in the right direction. Without employment, without education, without opportunity, without hope, we see what happens. And we'd like to be part of that positive move.
We're talking about the financing, the global financing, and how important a piece that is. Is public, some amount of public money must be involved in these projects as well.
Host country public money.
Sure. Yes. Yeah.
But no U.S. taxpayer money. This is, from our point of view, strictly private sector initiative.
Compare the situation not the situation in Iraq, but the opportunity in Iraq with the one in Libya.
The opportunity in Iraq is a comprehensive project or turnkey project in that we have to bring most of the financing. It becomes a private sector initiative after that. There's a lot of cash flowing over there, a lot of cash under mattresses. People can pay for these homes at a certain price point. So it's more of a market-based development, whereas the Libyan project will eventually be owned by the Libyan government in all likelihood. It'll be more of a classic university funded by tuitions, grants, some private investment, that sort of thing. So one is more of a private sector development. That's the Iraqi project, supported by the Iraqi government. The other is a more of a nonprofit classic university setting, also supported by the host government, but both large scale.
I know. Part of the impetus behind the Iraq project was the fact that there were so many Arabic speaking construction companies and executives in Southeast Michigan who could be a catalyst for that project.
Correct. Yeah, great team members, the Chaldean community over there specifically, and the huge Arab American population that is in that part of the state gives us great cultural insight, great design capabilities are over there. Some of our key team members are in the architectural and engineering industry over there, second generation people that will come over. And it's a very strong tie for them to be part of the rebuilding of their home country.
So. Yeah. Is Benghazi generally stable now? What's it like over there? I have to admit, I don't hear an awful lot about instability. A lot of what I hear is from the past.
Yeah. There's we were in Tripoli on our last trip. We did not go to Benghazi because of the situation there. There's a lot of dust yet to settle. In a lot of tensions between Tripoli and Benghazi, a lot of tribal tensions, but they're in flux right now. There's of course movements for power, and there are different elements and entities and factions all vying for national power. We all hope that things go in the right direction. By right direction, we mean democracy, stability, and a positive orientation toward the U.S. and the West.
Patrick McRae is Prima Civitas Director of International Programs. We're talking about a project in Iraq and a project in Benghazi, Libya, that Prima Civitas is involved in. Where's your next trip to, and what's on the agenda?
That's a good question. If I don't travel every couple of weeks, my feet get a little itchy, of course. We'll probably go to Turkey next. We have an event coming up there, and we're taking some MSU folks over, in fact. Probably in June. And if we're going to be meeting again with some Libyan officials in the near future, just for practical reasons, sometimes it's easier to meet in a third country such as Turkey. So probably go to Turkey next for Turkish business and perhaps to meet some of the Libyan officials and possibly some Iraqis as well.
Fascinating stuff. Patrick McRae of Prima Civitas, he's their Director of International Programs. We'll talk again soon, Pat. Thank you.
Sure thing. Thank you, Mark.
The 53rd season of the MSU Department of Theater's Summer Circle Theater opens tonight. MSU students stage plays outdoors, of course, next to Fairchild Theater along the Red Cedar River. Current state Scott Pohl spoke with Professor Rob Rosnowski about this season's schedule and the challenges of performing outdoors. One challenge this year is all the construction going on inside and outside the theater.
There is major renovation going on in the auditorium now, but it actually spills out near the Summer Circle area, so they'll be building out there as well, but stopping obviously for show times and things like that. But yeah, it's going to be exciting to be outside, away from the construction and dust.
All right, now for the benefit of our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with MSU's Summer Circle Theater, I want to ask you about the basics, including the history of offering outdoor summer theater here at MSU.
It's been going on for 53 years. It's really such a great outreach endeavor from the Department of Theater. We get audiences from all over the Lansing, East Lansing, Greater Lansing area to come in, and it's become family tradition. So families come and picnic and bring their children, sometimes their dogs, and it's really a great event that gets about 300 or 400 people a night to just come and see free theater on the banks of the Red Cedar.
Tell me about some of the challenges of staging student productions in the summer months. It makes me wonder about students who are perhaps away for the summer. Gee, I wish I had student X to play this part, but they have a job this summer, that sort of thing. Faculty members may be away. Are those challenges you face in staging outdoor plays in the summer?
Well, some of the challenges absolutely are those, but the other thing is that students are taking classes in the morning. So they take classes and then they go into rehearsal from about 1 till 10 at night with maybe one day off a week. And when we get into production, no days off. So it really becomes a challenge to balance their coursework along with all of their responsibilities doing several shows at one time.
So you have cast members who are in more than one of the shows.
Absolutely. Part of the fun of seeing Summer Circle is watching different people from week to week playing in different styles. So in one week you'll see them in a farce from the 1890s, and the next week a contemporary musical. So you get to see them test their versatility. It's really exciting.
They get to stretch their legs, maybe a comedic role one week, something really dramatic the next.
Exactly. I think that's part of what I love about it, is because they're rehearsing at the same time, they have to really switch their mindset going into one rehearsal hall from the other. They have to really start to figure out how best to use their time and how they can be different, because the audience has a short has a memory of them last week.
One thing I'm curious about is where rehearsals are held for the Summer Circle programs, because, and that's not all that unusual. I suppose that rehearsals would be in a different space from where you perform, but it's a whole different thing when you have to perform outdoors. Where do you rehearse? How does that play into the system here?
Well, we rehearse in several rooms throughout the auditorium, but the mindset of the subtle work that you're doing in the rehearsal room, translating that to outside, to outdoor theater, and where the farthest seat away is pretty far farther than some of our biggest theaters that we perform in. So it's sort of getting students into the mindset of, yes, that's true and that's truthful, and now we're doing it outside. So there has to be a switch or a rewiring of the way they normally perform, and that's sort of exciting too, because we have students that are training for film acting and then musical theater, and then you get to all of these different venues, and this is another part of performance that they have to get used to.
One other thing they have to get used to in performing outdoors is the unexpected, be it the weather. You mentioned people bringing dogs, mm-hmm. a dog barking, somebody going by on the river in a canoe making some noise. These are the sorts of challenges that an actor almost never faces indoors.
Right. I'll say the number one challenge for almost everyone is the mosquitoes, right? So you are there performing and you are being eaten alive. But also the idea, too, of a lot of our shows this summer are in Victorian period costumes. So the heat, along with all of those specific real costumes, really puts a challenge to the actor to perform. You're right also about all the distractions, because we're right by main thoroughfares. You have planes going overhead. You have people bike riding by. There's things that you just don't expect.
Has the weather ever been so nasty that you've moved indoors, or is it really rain or shine?
Since we've got microphones for our actors now, there really is a concerted effort to call a show if the rain is going to damage the actual equipment. Our audiences are pretty loyal, and they will sit there with umbrellas and garbage bags over them watching rain or shine. But we have had shows that have performed 1.5 times due to the rain. We sometimes do come inside to perform, but we're not an air-conditioned building, so it's really, which is worse? So, it really does depend on the weather.
Well, at least the mosquitoes maybe don't follow you indoors.
Exactly.
Well, what are a couple of the highlights of this season's schedule?
We open first with Charlie's Aunt, which is a comedic chestnut, and trying to put that show together, a farce from 1890, which is a very different style than most of our students have worked in before in 17 rehearsals, is a little bit crazy. So that opens the season. We follow that with Turn of the Screw, which is a mystery, a Henry James novella mystery, a two-person show. And then we have the musical Baby coming up after that. Other programming that we have includes Little Brother, Little Sister, which is playing with Turn of the Screw, and that's an absurdist drama. So you really get to see a variety of shows.
I find it interesting that some nights there is a second show. It's something of a double feature, mm-hmm. and the second show, I gather, at least some of the time, is a more adult theme or more challenging. Maybe the people who brought kids to the first show have left. Maybe some people come just for the later show. Is that part of the idea?
That is part of the idea. And so we have actual pre-show, which is 6 o'clock on Fridays and Saturdays. There's an original new children's show that's playing. And then on certain evenings, Fridays and Saturdays, after the main stage show, you will get that more adult programming. We'll be doing a reading of a play I wrote called Comfort Food, which is about food and history. And Little Brother, Little Sister is a more adult show than most of the things that we program.
Something tells me that when students from the MSU Theater Department return, graduates from the department, I should say, people who've gone on to careers in the theater, that one of their fondest memories of their days in East Lansing would include performing along the banks of the Red Cedar.
I totally agree, and it's amazing too. You know, I've been here for almost a decade now, and just the people that come back and that you meet every summer that recall fondly their time working at Summer Circle. We've been having a gala to celebrate, you know, every year for Summer Circle, and I think the 50th anniversary was just really special, where you just found people from all over the country sending their memories in about working. It really is a rite of passage at MSU Theater.
You know, it's interesting when you say that it's been 53 seasons now, or will be 53 seasons. The East Lansing Arts Festival just had its 50th, and lots of people were looking back at past festivals, some people who have attended every one of the 50. I'll bet there are lots of patrons who have been to nearly all of the programs in the 53 years of MSU's Summer Circle Theater.
That's exactly right. I mean, every year you see different faces returning or the same faces returning, and you start to put together, I don't know, I make up histories for them all and little family stories, but you know, like you just see the same family sitting in the same areas, sometimes bringing the same food with their friends. It really is a tradition, and that's the beautiful part of performing out there.
MSU Theater Professor Rob Rosnowski, you're in charge of Summer Circle Theater. Thank you so much for your time and good luck this season.
Thank you. I hope to see everyone there.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And Charlie's Aunt opens the Summer Circle Theater season tonight at 8 p.m. along the Red Cedar River next to MSU's Fairchild Theater. Well, did we stir up enough dust today? We talked about construction training, the construction industry, and the new home industry here in Michigan. We talked about it in the Middle East. Coming up tomorrow, many of you have no doubt at least read about the legendary Potterville Gizzard Fest over the years. Well, tomorrow we preview this annual culinary extravaganza. Maybe you've attended, maybe you haven't. We'll all learn more tomorrow here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Whorf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Becky McKendry for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.